Okay, money and markets. Some good days and a down day today. S&P now down 6% for the year, and that's 10 to, we're still in that 10 to 15% correction zone. Gold is having a good time. It's up 16%. Silver now up 11.9%. Again, in some respects, it looks like last year when in the third week of January, silver was up 16%, gold up almost 10%. And then, of course, we ended down the year down 12 and 11%. But to watch the experts flip back and forth, I just want to give you two quotes from Goldman Sachs that had me cracking up this week. On February 10th, Goldman said, bottom line, this is with respect to gold, bottom line, although 1200 to 1202 might hold in the near term, there's scope to extend much higher over time. So that's Goldman subtly saying, you know, gold could go up a lot. Then 5 days later on February 15th, they say, as we maintain our view of rising U.S. rates and hence lower gold prices with a 3-month target of 1100 per ounce and 12-month target of 1000 per ounce, we are recommending shorting gold through a GSCI style rolling index. So you wonder what they said today. I haven't seen an announcement from them. Franklin and I have a great discussion about precious metals. And one of the things I asked him was, why is this year different? You know, we got head faked last year. Why is this year different? He gives a very good explanation. He also put up some great charts. So go check out. It's a good interview. Oil now, it's bumped up a little bit, now down 24.75% for the year. The DAX is now, down 8% in the euro, down 12% in the dollar. Large cap China has been coming back. Large cap China is now down 13.7%. Developed world minus North America down 8%. Emerging markets outperforming the S&P, to our surprise, down 5.6%. The corporate or the bond aggregate ETF now up 1.84%. The 20-year Treasury ETF 8.76%. Up, that's down from 11% up, but still very strong performance for the year. Commodities index doing better. Commodities have been coming up a little bit, not across the board, but in many sectors. Commodities index now down 8% for the year. The U.S. dollar index is now down 1.88%. The line for real change in direction on the dollar is 92.50. We're not even close. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the news. The campaign, the U.S. presidential campaign, is clearly being used as entertainment to white out a lot of the news about the real problems. But I think, you know, even as white out, it's having a negative effect. One of my comments on Coast to Coast this week was I said that that the campaign comments from Trump, particularly, and the polls supporting them, about Muslims in November was very chilling for global investors. You're basically talking about saying, okay, this category based on religion can't come in. And it's not a big jump from saying that about a category. You're talking about almost 25% of the people on the planet who control some very big sovereign wealth funds and capital. It's not a big leap for an investor to say, uh-oh, maybe my capital is not free to come and go there. If they slam the door on Muslims, what are they going to do to their money? We have a history of financial sanctions and seizures, which are questionable, I think, in terms of international law. And it doesn't take a lot to look and listen to some of the campaign rhetoric in November. My immediate, it's funny, I had one person called me and said, look, you've got to be watching what Trump says. And I said, look, I'm just not going to get sucked into the campaign. She said, please, you've got to look at this. And I went and watched it and a chill went down my back. And I realized that if I was advising large institutional, if I was advising any investors in the Middle East, I'd tell them to get their money out of the country. And it wouldn't surprise me. Of course, if you're a big institution, you can't take it out all at once. So it wouldn't surprise me if that's part of what happened to the market in December and January. I think there are people who are averaging out. And it's not just one candidate and their comments. It's the increased sense of lawlessness and the governance structure not being under adult supervision. As I said, large funds cannot wait until the election. They've got to average out. If you look at PEs globally, the PEs have for many years been higher and are higher now in Switzerland. It's a perfect example of where a country has a real commitment to law and the kind of commitment you need to financial liquidity. It's very interesting when you deal with a bank or a money manager in Switzerland, if you say, you know, I want you to sell this and send, wire my money here. They say, yes, sir. And if you do it in the United States for the last 10, 15, 20 years, all you get is an argument. Why do you want to sell? And can we talk? And, you know, it's too sticky for words. And investors are very, very sensitive about financial liquidity. If there's any question that they can't take their money and run whenever they want to, they don't come. Now, there are profound contradictions between my red button story and the kind of campaign rhetoric we're listening to. In the red button story, people said that they wanted the intelligence agencies to keep marketing drugs into neighborhoods so that they are, you know, so that we could keep laundering $500 billion to $1 trillion a year in all dirty money, because they didn't want the stock market to go down. They didn't want the government deficit to not be financed. They didn't want their taxes to go up, etc. Well, good heavens, if the average American is willing to allow their neighbor's kids to be targeted and their kids to be targeted with drugs to keep the financial liquidity going, why in the world would you tell 24% of the people in the world to drop dead, that you didn't want them here? Because their assumption is, okay, well, I'll take my money. You know, so the multiple personality disorder between our actions absolutely shows the lack of literacy in the population about how the money works in our economy. And, you know, for that, I blame the absence of transparency around the federal budget and really financial statements for communities. So without that kind of literacy, we cannot close the gap between the official reality and reality. And that's why I keep hammering this point until I get boring with my froggy throat. Anyway, so you add the geopolitical tensions on top of that and the sort of drumbeats of war that are going on globally. And those are real pressures on the financial market. People are concerned. But it's not just leadership. It's the end of QE and debt growth. And the reality is quantitative easing and the explosion of debt papered over. You know, it gave us a cheap, temporary kind of liquidity that kept us from having to face the issues of economic non-sustainability, whether it's because we're behaving in ways that aren't productive or we have real problems with peak everything, et cetera, et cetera. So there's real global slowing going on. And of course, the shift to 2.0 to 3.0 is everywhere. Last year, in 2014, in one of the wrap-ups, I focused a lot on the impact of mobile technology and technology on retail stores, online versus brick, and the different changes within the retail distribution. And it's one of the articles I put up in Top Picks this week had a list of store closings, and you can really see the acceleration from bricks and mortar to online. Of course, some of it is slowing as well. Walmart's closing 269 stores, including 154 inside the United States. Kmart's closing more than two dozen stores over the next several months. JCPenney permanently shutting down 47 more stores after closing 40 in 2015. Macy's has decided it needs to shutter 36 stores. The Gap is in the process of closing 175 stores. Finish Line has announced 150 stores will be shutting. Sears has shut down over 600 stores over the past years, but sales of the stores that remain open continue to fall precipitously. It's interesting. I'm going to put up sometime this weekend a chart of Walmart stock. It's down by over a third over the last 2 years. And if you look at it, what you realize is what would have happened to Walmart stock if the energy price had not decreased significantly. When you think about their operations, both their real estate, trucking, planes, energy is a real big cost to Walmart. And of course, the energy prices dropped dramatically. They also are importing enormous amounts of goods from China. The dollar being strong has helped tremendously. So between a strong dollar and a lower energy price, if the energy price were to go back to where it was 2 years ago and the dollar was to break the 92.50 line, you kind of wonder, oh my God, what's going to happen to the people trying to eat based, you know, coming out of Walmart. So it's a great sort of picture into what's happening economically. Part of the push, unfortunately, and one of the things Franklin and I talk about, the more we centralize the economy, the weaker it gets. So the powers that be then try to control more, and then it gets weaker, and they try to control more. And he and I talked a lot about how do you reverse that, because what we need is more liquidity, more markets, more freedom, not less. I really think it's the people pulling their horns in because they don't trust the system and leadership, which is the single biggest problem. The pro-centralization team has now become the biggest centralized problem, and pumping out more QE and more debt won't cover up what they're up to. Anyway, two signs of the pressure to go cashless, of course, giving them more control and more ability to harvest through digital currencies. Larry Summers, former Secretary of Treasury, who engineered the housing bubble with Bob Rubin initially, called for the end of $100 bills, which is nuts. Martin Armstrong had a great piece pointing out that most of the 100 bills were outside the country, and said, you know, great job, Larry, if you're trying to kill us as the reserve currency. And then here's the real proof. The Monopoly game now has gone cashless. Again, Martin Armstrong had a really cute piece on his blog. Okay, Apple's in a squabble with the FBI, and of course we side with Apple on this one. It is ridiculous. The FBI says they need what they're asking for as to get information on the San Bernardino case. In essence, what they're doing is asking something for them that would give them unfettered access ultimately to all Apple's iPhones. It's nuts. Talk about overreach. I believe what they want is what they really want is they need that kind of access so they can do, you know, more complete mind control and more complete financial intelligence. The you know, the invasion of privacy and the use of these systems to harvest the consumer is unbelievable. I went to Morningstar to look for a particular kind of mutual fund this last week, and it was one I'd never researched at Morningstar before. I hadn't researched online. And sure enough, within an hour, I had a plethora of emails marketing exactly that kind of mutual fund. And of course, those companies immediately got deleted. If they're in the syndicate, they're out of my life. If you haven't, I had as the movie of the week, The Kingsman, a while ago. It's an absolutely dreadful movie. Whatever you do, don't let your kids watch it. It's so violent. It's completely over the top. But it really does describe the kind of mind control endgame we're talking about with the mobile phones, with the smartphones. And I really think it's very sobering. I know I and talk incessantly about the entrainment technology, but I assure you, I think if it wasn't for the entrainment technology, one, nobody would be watching the campaign, and certain candidates would have been non-starters a long time ago. Of course, we had Trump and Rubio come out and back the FBI in the Apple squabble. Every time you turn around, Rubio is the lawyer trying to destroy the Constitution and individual rights and liberties. So anyway, you wish you could hit the delete button. Good news, though, in the economy, the Silk Road is growing. And as we've talked a lot about, particularly in the 2014 wrap-up, the integration of the Silk Road and the infrastructure on the Silk Road is some of the most exciting things going on the planet. The first train, and I'm a railroader, I love trains, the first train connecting Iran and China loaded with Chinese goods arrived in Tehran Monday. And let me just read the article. Reviving the ancient Silk Road trade route and highlighting the economic possibilities for Iran since the lifting of international sanctions. The 5,900-mile trip from eastern China, or it's the eastern Xinjiang province, took 14 days, and that is 30 days less than a typical sea voyage between Shanghai and the Iranian port of Bandar Abbas. And so imagine now cutting out 30 days in your ability to ship from China to Iran. That is remarkable. Anyway, very exciting. Two interesting reports on China that I posted up on the website. China has now put out, since the beginning of the year, $1 trillion on loans. So they're not through with their debt bubble. Very good little piece on Hugh Hendry's comments on China from Bloomberg that I posted. Kyle Bassett basically predicted dire things for China, and Hendry came out and said, you know, China has a much brighter future than that. And I side with Hugh Hendry on that one. Scary trial balloon. Neil Kashkari, who helped Hank Paulson give the banks $27 trillion and effect the financial coup d'etat, ran for office unsuccessfully in California, and now has popped up as the Minneapolis president of the Fed. The idea that this guy should be president of Fed Bank really scares me. He gave a speech where he floated a trial balloon for breaking up the big banks to avert a meltdown. Clearly, while I find him scary and the idea of guys like him being in charge of coming up with these policies, let alone affecting them, the reality is we have ballooned financial capacity way beyond what we need. It needs to be cut back. The question is how we cut it back and change our banking and financial system to one that lifts up and encourages productivity in the financial and the sector, as well as the real economy, most importantly, the real economy. So expect this conversation of how to reduce the size of the banks. It's one of the reasons we're getting negative interest rates. We've ballooned their balance sheets, and now there's nowhere near enough business for them to do. They need to cut back. I wrote and put up two commentaries this week. The first is called Unanswered Questions, Hillary Clinton and the African American Community. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal today, why criminal justice reform could be a breakout issue for 2016. This is fascinating, and let me just read you two paragraphs from that article. And it's written by a firm that they're either a campaign firm or a polling firm. The takeaway from our results is that the criminal justice issues have evolved in the public consciousness. First, there was a discussion of the problem of crime and drugs. Next, solutions were offered. Then those solutions were implemented, and implementation created new problems. In 1986, it cost nearly $30 billion to incarcerate approximately 800,000 people in local, state, and federal jails and prisons. By 2010, the cost had risen to $80 billion to keep 2.3 million behind bars. I disagree with those numbers. In fact, if you look at the cost of the prisons and constructions, it's way much higher, but that's for another day. If you read the Dylan's read an Aristocracy of Stock Profits, you'll read a little bit more about that. So let me continue on. We found that people agreed with the premise that too much is spent to jail too many nonviolent offenders, and that the current system does a poor job of rehabilitation. A majority of respondents think that less expensive alternatives would produce better outcomes. Politics is a cynical business, but an issue has emerged in our acidic political environment that has achieved success in the states and is uniting Americans across the spectrum. Where voters go, their elected officials are sure to follow. So what he's saying is you have an 80% or better consensus, both sides of the aisle, you know, a broad section of society across many of the different divides that divide us. And so this could be a breakout issue. We saw Clinton try and give a speech on this earlier in the campaign, which didn't go over too well. Anyway, the occasion of my commentary, Hillary Clinton and the African-American community, Bernie Sanders had his first ad pitched to the African-American community, and it was a doozy. And it's very much in the keeping with this theory of there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And the idea that the tensions in the campaign, which are supposed to be entertainment, and, you know, sort of keep everybody busy, you know, we are seeing some cracks. Anyway, Sanders' ad was definitely a crack. And so I sort of went through the issues of why I think Hillary Clinton is unbelievably vulnerable on this point. If you look at what the Clinton administration did to the African-American community, I'm always stunned that, I'm stunned that any American would vote for them, but I'm really stunned that anybody in the African-American community would. So finally had to say something. Needless to say, as soon as we put it out and publicized it, you know, what happened? More miracle. Our new website that we're working on got hacked, and more email problems and all kinds of systems problems. It's really, whenever I publish something like this, I my first question is, am I willing to spend $2,000 to $5,000 in overhead to say this? And sometimes the answer is definitely yes. The other thing I put up was a book review of a phenomenal book called Addiction by Design, a very serious academic study by clearly a brilliant and capable professor from MIT on the growth of machine gambling. It's one of the most frightening books I've ever read. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to read it, because I'm stunned when anybody would vote for somebody who became a billionaire in the casino business. And I won't even start about money laundering and why casinos really exist. But, you know, you're talking about a business that has developed and used mind control to hook in and addict and destroy consumers. It's just appalling to me that this is legal. But I would encourage you to read that review, because the problem is not that machine gambling is hurting a lot of people. The problem is, if you look at what's coming with 5G technology and virtual reality, the ability of machines to addict people and kids is growing dramatically. And I think it's something we all need to think about how we're going to manage, particularly if you have kids or grandkids. Okay. As I said, our hero for the week is Justice Scalia, because of his incredible defense of the Constitution. And if you talk to lawyers, there's a great editorial in the Wall Street Journal by either a professor or dean of the law school at Stanford talking about the extraordinary nature of his opinions, written opinions over many years, and how much he and others had learned from the Constitution and how he'd used it with his students to teach the Constitution. Now, just because I admire somebody doesn't mean I agree with them on every comment or every opinion. Everybody, you know, we live in a world where there are thousands of things to have opinions on, and if we're required to agree with everybody on all thousand, you know, we'll all live in an isolated world of one, which is exactly what the guys at the top want, which is why we see so many divide and conquer things played on us. But I got a very nasty note from a Coast listener, not from a subscriber, just berating me on saying anything nice about Judge Scalia because of some of his positions on homosexuality. And I felt it was appropriate to say something because it'll really help you understand my point of view. What I really care about the most, it's a matter of priorities. I've spent a lot of time in Washington, and I know the importance of focusing on your priorities in the political process. What I care about are the primary rights that apply to everybody, those things that unify all of us. I care about everybody's property rights, everybody's privacy rights, and I care about the enforcement of the Constitution on the things that affect all of us, particularly with respect to government finances. If our property rights, our privacy rights, and our government finances were protected and the Constitution was enforced under those things, I assure you we'd be having a lot less divide and conquer issues. For my entire life, I've watched divide and conquer issues being used to divide the electorate so that a handful of people could destroy everybody's property rights, destroy everybody's privacy rights, and steal everyone's money. The reason they can get away with it is they've got that divide and conquer thing going. I've always told you, you know, when I first got to Tennessee, I live in a very segregated community. I used to say to everybody, look, if you could just collaborate about the money, you could hate each other rich instead of hating each other poor. But it fell on mostly deaf ears. So if you bring up or try and slap me in the face with any divide and conquer issue, it's not because they're not important. So individual rights are very important, and protecting everybody and any particular subset is always important. But here's the reality. I care a lot more, first and foremost, about your property rights, your privacy rights, and your money being stolen, and watching people who are risking their lives to protect those things for you, watching people spit on them. And I know you don't understand the real agenda when you're doing that, but please, please, please see the real game, because much of the promotion of those particular issues, particularly men versus women, heterosexual versus homosexual, all of that stuff was created so that they could keep you away from those bigger issues and roll you on those bigger issues and roll all of us. So please see the deeper game, please, please, please. But don't be surprised if I get my back up, if you slap me upside the face on a divide and conquer issue. If you haven't listened to the interviews, the discussions I did with Junius and Ricardo Stanton on divide and conquer, there's a lot more there.